This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allowed us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, 7th of July 2016. Our speaker today is Dr. Frank Brennan. Frank is a palliative care physician based in Sydney. He has worked closely with the Department of Nephrology at St. George Hospital and has established a renal supportive care service. We're delighted he can join us today to present some of his work. Thank you, Frank. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, May, and good morning to everyone there. So today I'm going to talk about the topic of renal supportive care, and I guess an interesting area for all of us working in palliative care or with an interest in palliative care is the interface with non-malignant disease. So I'm going to work through this lecture and then take some questions at the end. Whoever's operating the slides, next slide, or slide two. So some 2 years ago, I met this woman, an Aboriginal woman, 53-year-old, type 2 diabetes mellitus with hypertension. She had diabetic nephropathy. She was on hemodialysis 3 times a week. She had been doing this for 5 years. She was married to a 53-year-old Aboriginal man with almost an identical history, also on dialysis. They were elders in the community. They had strong cultural responsibilities, but effectively she was not able to do this because she was so overwhelmed by symptoms. Next slide. She shuffled into the clinic room. Her head was down. There was no eye contact. Next slide. My legs moved through all the night, she described. And so she was presenting with severe uremic restless leg syndrome and had had that for 2 years. Next slide. She said, I itch all the time. Often it becomes ferocious. And note the word ferocious, just describing how awful this symptom is. She had severe uremic pruritus for about 3 years. Next slide. My feet and calves burn and get pins and needles. It is awful. So she had severe diabetic peripheral neuropathy lasting about 18 months. Next slide. And sleep, I asked. Next slide. I don't sleep. I doze in 5 minutes lots, she replied. I sit on a chair and put my elbows on my knees to hold them still, and I pray to die. What an extraordinary picture of suffering this woman was exhibiting, and just completely overwhelmed by these very, very awful symptoms. We'll come back to her a little bit later and talk about what we could do or what we did do for her on that day. So the overview of the lecture, I guess, is to talk about the interface of these two disciplines. What are the disciplines of nephrology and palliative care? Next slide. So we're now on slide 9. Now, next slide, slide 10. What possible role does palliative care have in nephrology? And I guess that this interface we'll talk a little bit more about. Next slide. Look, talk about the core competencies in renal supportive care from both disciplines' point of view, the core competencies from palliative care but also from nephrology. Next. Decision-making around dialysis, including the possible withholding and withdrawing from dialysis, is a very critical issue in nephrology. We'll cover that. Next, slide 13. What exactly is the conservative non-dialytic management of end-stage renal disease? Because if that consensus decision is made that for a particular patient dialysis is not appropriate, that's the first question that's going to be asked is to the nephrologist, how are you going to treat me? What is this conservative management looking like? Next slide. We'll talk a little bit about symptom management. Next slide. We'll talk also about the care of the dying patient with end-stage renal disease, a very important aspect. Next slide. So let's talk about the disciplines of nephrology and palliative care. Next slide. Nephrology is the discipline that concentrates on the diagnosis and management of kidney disease. It does include, but there's many more aspects, but certainly a major aspect is overseeing renal replacement therapy, that is hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, or transplantation. Next slide. What is palliative care? Well, certainly to this audience, I don't need to go into detail, but as you, of course, have been sitting in on this series and indeed working within palliative care. Next slide. This I find a useful, I suppose, metaphor for many audiences. This is a desert region in Australia. When European settlers came to this area, they saw this as a godforsaken country of no use. And it was only through the eyes of great artists like this Aboriginal artist, Albert Namatjira, that people started to see this country with the eye of beauty. So I guess the metaphor here is looking upon the landscape of our patients with serious life-limiting illnesses with the two eyes. Yes, the active eye, of course, in the context of cancer, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, in the context of patients with end-stage renal disease, renal replacement therapy, but also the palliative eye. And this can be done concurrently. It doesn't have to be one and then finally with exhaustion, therapeutic or otherwise, the clinicians then turn to palliative care. So I guess the two eyes on the landscape of our patients. Next slide is simply slide 20. Then we'll move on to slide 21. What possible role does palliative care have in nephrology? This is a critical question as we embarked on this journey. Certainly for nephrology, because that was a query that was being posed to us. Why would your discipline have a role in our discipline? So perhaps there's several answers to this. Next slide, slide 22. The first answer is epidemiology. Next slide. I think it's really fascinating, the history here, because in 1978, the average age of an Australasian starting on dialysis was 40. Now it's 60 plus. In the United States, it's 65. Also fascinatingly, at that time in 1978, the proportion that had diabetic nephropathy was about 5%. But now this is substantially growing, and in many countries, it's 35 to 50% of patients with diabetic nephropathy. So a huge shift in epidemiology. The other major shift is the base. So I'll just, next slide, slide 24. So in Australasia, the mean age of patients commencing renal replacement therapy is 60 years, but certainly growing each year. Next slide, slide 25. This is interesting. The age cohort that is the greatest prevalence on dialysis is the 65 to 84-year-old age group. That represents a massive shift from those early days of dialysis in the 1960s and 1970s. So now in the literature, there's being more and more focus on what they're describing as geriatric nephrology. Also, think about this age group. Not only are they dealing with end-stage renal disease, but often issues of their own other comorbidities, particularly musculoskeletal disease and potential frailty, and also what's happening in their own families, the illness and potential death of their own spouse, the care of grandchildren, travel, so many other different things happening in this age group. So I think it's always good to have a broader perspective, but certainly that is the remarkable fact, and this is around the Western world, the greatest prevalence of greatest age group cohort on dialysis is the 65 to 84-year-old age group. Next slide. So, and also there's this remarkable story of the global epidemiology of diabetic nephropathy. Next slide, slide 27. The percentage of incident patients with end-stage renal disease with diabetic nephropathy is now heading towards or greater than 50% Singapore, Malaysia, New Zealand, and 40 to 50% in those other countries. So this is a major story that's unfolding. Not only diabetic nephropathy, but diabetic peripheral neuropathy, retinopathy, macro and microvascular disease, of course. Next slide, slide 28. And of course, the significantly disproportionate impact of diabetes and diabetic nephropathy on the indigenous populations of both of our countries. Next slide. Does everyone who has end-stage renal disease commence dialysis? This was a question I posed to my colleagues when I started. Yes, there's a group coming to you, but is everyone on dialysis with end-stage renal disease? We actually didn't have an answer to that until a couple of years ago, next slide, when this study was a beautiful study was done. And they found that in Australia, for every one patient with end-stage renal disease receiving renal replacement therapy, there was another one who did not receive renal replacement therapy. Now, the reason they did not not could be lots of different reasons, including patient choice or comorbidities and frailty, sitting with your GP and the GP saying, look, you've got so many, or a geriatrician indeed, of course, we've got so many other issues here. Look, this is one among many, and really dialysis perhaps is not the right thing for you. So lots of different reasons why patients may not necessarily present. But the question then is, how are they being cared for? This particular group who are not on dialysis, what is their conservative management? Next slide, slide 31. So epidemiology is one interface of the two disciplines. The next discipline, next issue is mortality. Next slide, slide 32. Overall, patients with end-stage renal disease, whether or not they're having dialysis, have a reduced life expectancy compared to age-matched controls. And this is one of the slight myths, is that if you start my father on dialysis, he can expect to have a normal life expectancy. Unfortunately not. Next slide. For patients on dialysis, this is Ann Starter across the two countries, about 13.7% die each year. Now, this is all adults, so about 14% annual mortality. Next slide. But if you're 75 and above, that figure is 25%. So if you're 75 and above now starting on dialysis, say today, at the end of 2 years, half of your cohort will have passed away. So that's a significant mortality figures and comparable to many malignancies. Next slide. So we've talked about epidemiology, we've talked about mortality, and now symptomatology. Next slide. Patients with CKD, especially those with end-stage renal disease, are among the most symptomatic of any chronic disease group, and certainly think of the patient case that I started with. Next slide. The next issue is quality of life. So this has been tested, looked at around the world, and certainly we've done it here. And next slide, you can see the results here. So this is a quality of life SS36. The bottom line, sorry, the top line, age-related patients with no illness. But the bottom lines are the patients on dialysis. And as you can see on the the left-hand side of the screen are the physical domains. The right-hand side of the screen are the emotional or mental health domains. So certainly there's a consistent, over many years from 2001 onwards, where there's a consistent deficit in quality of life, particularly the physical domains. And despite this particular department doing many things to try and elevate that or move that quality of life, not much shift despite those changes. Next slide, slide 39. And then finally, the quality of dying. So I guess, how do patients die with end-stage renal disease? And that's a critical aspect as well. Next slide. So the interface of nephrology and palliative care, I think that there's probably five parts here: epidemiology, mortality, morbidity, quality of life, and quality of dying. And it was precisely those issues that the head of Department of Nephrology here approached us some years ago and said, look, as nephrologists, we have high skills in our own area, but we struggle with the symptoms, we struggle with shifting quality of life, and we certainly struggle with how to care for a dying patient. We need your help. So that was the beginning of the journey, if you like. Next slide. So what are the core competencies in renal supportive care for both disciplines? Next slide. Realistically, given issues of manpower, it may not be possible, indeed it is not possible, for a palliative care professional to be present in every renal unit. So really, if we're going to look at upskilling both of our disciplines, and certainly the discipline of nephrology, what are those skills? Next slide, slide 43. What are these core competencies? Next slide. Well, I would say that there's the classic four pillars of a palliative approach, of course: excellence of communication, excellence in meticulous symptom management, psychosocial support, and care of the dying patient. And that's what we're doing as much as we're able to, of course, in courses and lecture series, etc., etc., for nephrology trainees and nephrologists themselves. Last year was the first Australasian masterclass in renal supportive care held in Sydney. In August next month, it'll be held in Brisbane, and I'd encourage any of you to attend that with a full comprehensive analysis of this area. Next slide, slide 45. Let's talk a little bit about communication. Next slide. Once end-stage renal disease is diagnosed, it's important to examine the various options. Next slide. So really, it's coming down to this. Are we going to look towards dialysis or transplantation, or is a conservative management the better approach? Next slide. So now we're embarking on this question, the decision making around dialysis. Next slide. Survival is probably a very important part here. And I suppose you may start with the feeling that any patient in any condition is going to survive longer on dialysis than not. Is that correct? For a long time we had anecdote and we had an instinct, a professional instinct among nephrologists. But a couple of years ago there was a seminal article published, a seminal study, and that was followed by a series of studies with almost identical methodology saying very much the same thing. Next slide. So this was the first study from Fliss Murtagh, a palliative care specialist in England. So what they did is they looked at a group of patients with end-stage renal disease who were 75 and above, some of whom went down dialysis route, some of whom went down a conservative group. What happened to those two groups? Next slide. Well, as you can see, there was a clear survivorship advantage for those who went on dialysis. However, and it was a significant, however, next slide, if you factored in comorbidities, particularly ischemic heart disease, those Kaplan-Meier curves collapsed. So this was the first study that started to indicate that there would be a cohort, which this particular group may not actually have a survivorship advantage being on dialysis. Next slide. Chandra followed this, and as you can see, some patients on a conservative or a dialysis group, and you can see that if they're in the low comorbidity versus high comorbidity, those curves being very, very close and moving to a junction. Also, this study, which was a really major wake-up call in the United States from the New England Journal. So this is frail. This is nursing home patients in the United States being started on dialysis. So what happened to them? Next slide. This is slide now 55. Well, as you can see, this, my goodness me, after by 1 year, you know, 70% plus of these patients had died. So a significant mortality. And also those who survived a significant falling off in their physical function, their ADLs. But also just note the comorbidities here. Significant, you know, two-thirds with diabetes. But one of the most troubling aspects was 22% of these patients had dementia. The study doesn't talk about the level of dementia, but this was started to enter the discourse in the United States. Is it right for us to be placing demented patients on dialysis? And certainly when you look at the results of this, following dialysis, high mortality and high collapse in functional status. Next slide, slide 56. And as you can see, the ADLs falling off, mortality going up. Next slide, slide 57. So there was another study that we did here in Sydney looking at CKD in elderly patients managed without dialysis, survival symptoms and quality of life. But we also looked at dialysis patients as well. Next slide. And our conclusion was statistically that in patients over 75 years with two or more comorbidities, one of which was ischemic heart disease or congestive cardiac failure, there was no survival advantage with dialysis compared to those who did not commence dialysis. So this is perhaps the first Australasian study compared to those North American studies with a very, very similar result. Next slide. And indeed, in our group, one-third of the non-dialysis patients lived more than 12 months after the eGFR fell below 10. And it's around about 9 to 10 is the usual point of really making a major decision to start dialysis or not, that is, the decision may come earlier. This surprised everyone. The whole thing of, well, the understanding or the estimation was surely with such a low eGFR, people are going to be dying quite quickly. But this remarkable figure of one-third surviving more than 12 months and not on dialysis. Next slide, slide 60. A lot of this material then came to fruition, if you like, or consensus in this seminal document that was published in 2010 by the Renal Physicians Association, the United States, and I'll let you read its title. Next slide. So they put out several recommendations. They said it was reasonable to consider foregoing dialysis for those patients who have very poor prognosis or for whom dialysis cannot be provided safely. They said not recommending dialysis or moving down a conservative pathway is not euthanasia. It's not medical abandonment, or it ought not to be. It's not second best treatment. If this is a reasonable, and certainly looking at those studies, if it's reasonable to recommend, it is reasonable to recommend, and reassuring physicians in the United States that they're on firm ground in a certain cohort of patients to look towards a non-dialysis pathway. Next slide, slide 62. And they recommend that those whose medical, they talked about it was reasonable to consider foregoing dialysis, those whose medical condition precludes the technical process because the patient is unable to cooperate, is pulling at their lines or leaping off their chair, of course, in dialysis, or unstable medically significant hypotension. I don't think there'd be any controversy there. Next slide. Also, another life-limiting illness, although this may make, and this is the situation where a patient's on dialysis and now has metastatic malignancy. Most patients in our experience want to continue on dialysis until they can't, until the anorexia, cachexia, or the malignancy is such that they're ready to stop. Next slide. But this is perhaps a core aspect then. They're talking about this group, as in it would be reasonable to consider foregoing. Those patients who are over 75 years with two or more of the following statistically significant criteria predictive of very poor prognosis. Surprise question. As a clinician, would you be surprised if this patient died in the next 6 to 12 months? If the answer is no, I would not be surprised. That's been statistically correlated with prognosis. High comorbidity score, very poor functional status, Konoski less than 40, and severe chronic malnutrition. So note it's not a simple age. If it was age, it would be ageism potentially, wouldn't it? Because you could potentially have a patient a year older than that particular age saying, look, I'm very robust apart from my kidney disease. So it's not simply age, but it's these other factors that start to come in. And indeed, it's not only this particular group, the age plus these factors. It could be a younger patient with overwhelming issues where it's appropriate to perhaps not recommend dialysis, but certainly in the modern era, it's this group that's being mainly focused on, the over 75 with these issues coming to bear. Next slide. So what exactly is, if you are going to move to a conservative management, what does that look like? Next slide. So 66, slide 66. This may be decided in consultation with a nephrologist, or the patient was never referred to a nephrologist in the first place. Next slide, 67. So what level of care should occur for this group? Next slide. So if this is being raised as an option, what does it mean? What's its content? And can we make predictions about their course? Next slide, 69. So I guess the question that's going to happen, be asked is, what happens to me if I don't start dialysis? What will happen to me? Okay, next slide. And I guess the challenge is to ensure that this pathway of management is not seen as second best or inadequate, but as thorough, systematic, and evidence-based. Of course. And it's this particular group that's now being studied more, this group that are on a conservative pathway, what happens to them over time? Next slide. I guess the important thing, very important thing, is that there's no medical abandonment here, that there's no, I don't need to see you anymore. And we're now very much incorporated in our practice and in the practice around other units, that the nephrologist continues to see the patient all the way through. It's the nephrologist that has the skills in terms of the erythropoietin, the blood pressure management, the calcium and phosphate management, fluid status, etc. So I think that that's really important, that nephrologists continue practicing excellent nephrology, excellent renal medicine. Next slide. And it's not simply sending all patients to palliative care, because that may or may not be appropriate. Next slide. Slide 73. So I would propose, in answer to this question, how to manage someone with on a conservative pathway, it's two approaches. It's excellence of renal medicine and excellence of palliative approach or palliative medicine. It's this combination, the two eyes on the landscape of our patients. And indeed, this slide could cover the whole of renal supportive care, dialysis and non-dialysis. But it's this combination that is going to be most useful and most helpful to the patient. Next slide, slide 74. So this is an interesting study, again, by the Murtagh group that followed a group of conservative patients and what happened to them. They had 73 participants. About two-thirds did die during the follow-up. The mean age was 81. And the end points were symptoms, palliative needs, and functional status. What happened to this conservative group? Next slide. So as you can see, functional status continued on often remarkably longer than everyone expects, between about 60 and 70, and then about 2 months before death, there's a fall off in functional status, taking to the chair, taking to the bed, becoming less well. Next slide. In terms of symptom distress, yes, again, 2 months before death, an increase in symptomatology. Next slide. And palliative care needs 2 months, 2 months before death. So this may answer the question as where palliative care, mainstream palliative care, should be involved in this group of patients. Probably not earlier. There's probably no need if it's possible for the nephrologist, the general practitioner, and indeed having a renal supportive care service within the Department of Nephrology, being able to care for those patients. But certainly when things are starting to really change and it's about 2 months before death, then that might be the point of having the mainstream palliative care team involved. Next slide. Symptom management at slide 78. 79. Well, again, Murtagh, who's done so much work in this, basically pulled together huge numbers of studies looking at symptomatology in this group of patients, mainly dialysis patients. Next slide. So Murtagh and a group looked at those on a conservative pathway, and we've also done a study on the conservative symptomatology of those on patients managed without dialysis. Next slide, slide 81. And as you can see, the list of symptoms there. Very heavy weight of symptoms, as you can see, and not only individual symptoms, but multiple symptoms the patients are troubled by. I guess that puts at rest any myth that if you're placed on dialysis, your symptoms will disappear. Often symptoms will start to alleviate or shift, but they certainly don't disappear. Next slide. Symptoms control is challenging. Next slide. Symptoms interact and compound with each other. Next slide. So this isn't a good example. At night time, and the patient at the first part of the talk is a good example, being really troubled with itch, restless legs, and restless legs is classically nocturnal, or pain, then having very, very troubled sleep and then contributing to daytime somnolence and fatigue. Fatigue is complex and multifactorial. It's not simply this combination. But often disturbances of sleep leading to another symptom of insomnia, leading to greater fatigue. However, if you can deal with the initial symptoms, the core symptoms, then it may well be that you're going to provide a significant sleep dividend to this patient, an improvement in sleep and overall quality of life with less daytime somnolence. Next slide, slide 85. The symptoms, of course, may derive from the comorbidities. Remember the cohort, the age cohort, the highest age cohort, 65 to 84-year-olds. And the issue of diabetes. Next slide. Now, the actual end-stage renal disease constrains the use of medications, so there's a great care that needs to be brought to this group of patients. Next slide. The pharmacology is this complex with autopharmacokinetics of most medications in renal impairment. Next slide. There are multiple gaps in knowledge. Next. Recommendations and published data occasionally conflict on the specific doses of medications to be used, so that does make it harder in terms of looking to authorities for guidance. Next slide. So I think in terms of the principles of symptom management, we, of course, in any context, malignant or non-malignant, we need to think of the cause, being meticulous, and also the principle of non-abandonment, always sitting with the patient, doing our best, researching, thinking, asking colleagues what else can be done, referring on if it's not possible, and indeed just sitting with patients and talking to them about how they're going. Next slide. So I'm just going to quickly, I cannot because of time speak about all symptoms. I'm going to talk about these particular symptoms, uremic pruritus, restless legs and pain. Next slide. Uremic pruritus. Next slide. It's associated with poor sleep quality, depression, poor quality of life and mortality. The mortality probably is chronic sleep deprivation, cytokine release and cardiovascular risk factors. Next slide. The pathogenesis of pruritus is complex and is only just being now looked at. The last probably 10 or more years is being unpacked and there's a much better understanding. But there's a couple of surprises here. Next slide. There is a complex neural network, of course. Next slide. It's mainly involves C fibers, but A delta fibers as well. Next slide. About 5% of those fibres are itch sensitive. Next slide. For many years, the assumption was that it was all to do with histamine. Next slide. But in fact, only about 10 to 20% are histamine sensitive and about 80% are histamine insensitive. So there's this enormous non-histaminergic story with itch. Next slide. So there are a couple of myths. First of all itch is histamine mediated. Next slide, slide 101. The next myth is the best first-line medication for pruritus of whatever cause are antihistamines. And in fact, they don't work in many conditions. Next slide. So the pathogenesis of myrmic pruritus is multiple different theories, but we actually don't know. Next slide. Then slide 104, and I'll let you read that quote. In other words, we don't know. So more work needs to be done here. Next slide, slide 105. There are a large number of therapies described. Next slide. What therapies have the strongest foundation and evidence-based practice? Next slide. Well, topical preparations, oral medications, and ultraviolet therapy. Next slide. First of all is moisturizers. Xerosis or dry skin is not a cause, but it's certainly an exacerbating factor. So using creams such as sorbolene or QV cream to moisturize are excellent. Next slide. Capsaicin cream does work, but it does cause that transient burning feeling on the skin and often is not tolerated. Next slide, 110. The next is gabapentin. Okay, so there's been a very nice qualitative systemic review looking at all the data on the studies on this, and they've concluded on slide 112. Next slide, I'll let you read there. So this is what we're starting. We're starting gabapentin 100 milligrams after dialysis for our patients who are on dialysis. If they're on a conservative pathway with an eGFR under 15, 100 milligrams every second night. And if their eGFR is better than 15, 100 milligrams nocte. And then moving doses up. Pregabalin, yes, we do use that. And of course, the smallest dose is 25 milligrams in an equivalent dosing schedule. Next slide. So this is what we use. 113. Next slide, 114. Next slide, 115. Next slide, pregabalin. Next slide. There have been several prospective cohort studies showing efficacy. So while not as well studied as gabapentin, I feel it's a class effect, and almost certainly this medication will have benefit. Next slide. Evening primrose oil. Next slide. Now, the active constituent in evening primroses oil is gabalinolenic acid. Next slide, 110. So in our epidermis, we have essential fatty acids, a cascade. Next slide. So you can see this cascade from linolenic acid down. And the theory is, in a uremic pruritic patient, there's a deficit of the first parts of this cascade. It rushes down to arachidonic acid, and arachidonic acid then side-produces some highly pruritogenic cytokines. Next slide. These cytokines, prostaglandin E2 and leukotriene B4. So gabalinolenic acid is a constituent member of the evening primrose oil. It's there. It supplements, in other words, the first part of this cascade. So it's not going to rush down. It's actually going to go to DGLA. Next slide. And DGLA then, in turn, side-produces some anti-pruritogenic, anti-inflammatory cytokines. So that's almost certainly its efficacy. So next slide, 124, supplementing the gabalinolenic acid has an anti-inflammatory, anti-itch effect. Next slide, 125. So we use 1 to 2 capsules twice a day, and it's mostly well tolerated, and it can be bought over the counter at the chemist. Next slide. Sertraline. Next slide. One good trial, before and after trial, 19 hemodialysis patients, 50 milligrams daily, and they did show a significant benefit. Next slide, 128. Thalidomide, yes, a good study from 1994. Very difficult to get hold of course, but efficacy there in thalidomide. Next slide. So oral med 129. So antihistamines, well, the evidence doesn't support. Ondansetron, conflicting results, not recommended. Cimetidine, not recommended. Naltrexone, again, conflicting results, not recommended. Next slide. So then the ultraviolet B therapy, there's efficacy there, of course. But, of course, you do need to have a dermatologist, and, of course, a dermatologist is able to do this therapy. But, yes, there's efficacy there. So in summary, really, it's moisturizers plus gabapentin, pregabalin, evening primrose oil, ultraviolet B therapy, and potentially others. Next slide. Restless leg syndrome. Next slide. Well, this is an awful feeling, and remember that first patient. It's defined as an urge to move the limbs, usually with a feeling in the legs that often is hard to describe, a shuffling of the legs, usually while at rest and made better by standing up and walking around, and it's worse at night. So it can be terribly difficult for patients and can affect their sleep in a major way. Next slide. Incidence in the general population and end-stage renal disease. Next slide. The mechanism is not completely understood. Next slide. So this is probably where the issue is. It's in the substantia nigra or the basal ganglia. So as you know, tyrosine, tyrosine hydroxylase, L-DOPA, dopamine is then packaged into vesicles and then passed across to the dopamine 2 receptors. Iron is an extremely important part of this whole process. Iron is a cofactor in tyrosine hydroxylase. Iron is part of the packaging mechanism for dopamine, and iron sits in the dopamine 2 receptors. So next slide. So the issue is some defect in iron transport, slowing this whole process down, and it's very diurnal. There's a high diurnal mechanism in iron metabolism, and also in terms of the connection between this particular area of the brain, the hypothalamus, which has the circadian clock. So there's a high, as I said, a high circadian story there. So this is brain iron metabolism, not systemic iron metabolism. Next slide, 138. So this has been the traditional medicine used by nephrologists. As you know, this is a long-acting benzodiazepine, and it certainly can help, but it can cause people to be feeling quite groggy the following morning. Next slide. The dopamine agonists, next slide. So it's the second group that are the much safer ones. We don't use the first group, the non-ergot dopamine agonists, and we use either pamprexole or ropinirole, and I'd look up that in terms of what the trade names are there in New Zealand, but it's one of those two that we often use. Next slide. Gabapentin. Now here, this is interesting because we've already referred to gabapentin in one other symptom. Next slide. So there are two level RCT showing efficacy for gabapentin, one placebo-controlled and one compared to L-DOPA and showing statistically significant benefit. Next slide. So that's fascinating, isn't it, that we've actually got two particular uremic symptoms of uremic pruritus with one class of medicine potentially being able to deal with both. Next slide. I'm going to move through this in terms of time. Pain is a large subject, 143. It's a very common subject, slide 144, as we saw from the figures earlier. Next slide, 145. About half reported in that particular study reported the pain as moderate to severe. Next slide. The data is more limited but shows similar prevalence. Next slide. There's a significant impact on quality of life and function. Next slide. In Davison's case, studies of about 69 dialysis patients, 62% said it interfered with their ability to participate and enjoy recreational activities. Next slide. Half said it caused them extreme suffering. And this remarkable figure, 41% said the pain was enough for them to say, enough with everything, I want to stop my dialysis. So this is a major issue, isn't it? Next slide. There's a positive correlation with depression. Next slide. The causes of pain, well, we need to carefully unpack this. Is the pain relating to the end-stage renal disease itself, the treatment or comorbidities? Next slide. But so the disease itself, things like polycystic kidney disease, bone disease, amyloid or calciphylaxis. Next slide. Could be treatment, of course, the abdominal pain, peritonism, Steele syndrome, where there's insufficient circulation coming down to the hand, where the fistula side, cramps or intradialytic headaches. Next slide. Slide 155. And then, of course, this large group in particularly the older group of osteoarthritis, diabetic peripheral neuropathy, peripheral vascular disease, ischemic heart disease, gouty arthropathy, post-herpetic neuralgia, etc., etc. Next slide. So, and of course, you have may meet the patient with multiple causality. And I remember meeting a patient who had five separate pain syndromes when I met her. Next slide. So in terms of the pain etiquette, I think in this group, we need to inquire regularly. We need to respond compassionately, treat competently, and certainly for ourselves within palliative care, referring on to pain clinicians, pain medicine clinicians. For those in nephrology, making sure that pain is being attended to and not ignoring the pain. Next slide. So the principles, of course, are very much the same as we would in all aspects of palliative care. Next slide. So what are the, how can we move to a strategic approach? Next slide. Look, well, there are very few studies examining pain management in this particular group. Next slide, 161. There are however, there are international evidence-based guidelines on several pain syndromes. So next slide. And there, those guidelines would include pain management of osteoarthritis, painful diabetic peripheral neuropathy, and of course, cancer pain. Next slide. So there's an increasing, although not complete, understanding of the pharmacology of these medications. Next slide. And these recommendations could be filtered through the known pharmacology of medications in the context of CKD and their dialyzability. So that's probably the approach is to look at what is the pain. Is it diabetic peripheral neuropathy? Is it osteoarthritis? Then looking at, this is slide now, 165, what are the evidence-based guidelines on the entire population? Then filtering that through the known pharmacokinetics and dynamics of these medications, and then finally coming to a conclusion, rather than leaping directly to the WHO ladder because you in fact may be using incorrect medicines. So very much it's all of us, we need to learn a lot, and indeed on July 30th here in Sydney, we're going to have an entire day on pain management in end-stage renal disease, where we're going to bring all the disciplines together, geriatrics, pain medicine, palliative care, nephrology, to talk through this whole issue and go through what is understood there. And you're most welcome to attend that. That'll be in Sydney on July 30th. Next slide, 166. So this is perhaps reflected in this paper that I was part of, looking at how we possibly do this, where we looked at the entire literature on pain management and end-stage renal disease. Next slide. And then Holly Konchiki followed up with that particular article as well. Next slide. So remember Our Lady, who was so overwhelmed. Next slide, slide 169, with all those symptoms. What do we do for her? Well, we started her with gabapentin. I wanted to start her with gabapentin because I knew that there was evidence for the use of gabapentinoids across all three conditions, uremic pruritus, restless legs, and diabetic peripheral neuropathy. I gave her a higher dose. Why? Well, one was she was younger than so many of our patients, but because the symptoms were so spectacularly awful for her. So about nine, this was in a country area. 9 days later, I rang through to that dialysis unit, slide 171, next slide, and they said that there'd been a complete resolution of these symptoms and also this incredible benefit to her in sleep. Now, initially, I thought, is this a very powerful placebo effect? But I thought, well, it may be, but certainly there is evidence for the use of the gabapentinoids across the symptoms, and what a remarkable benefit for her. Next slide. Care of the dying patient. Next slide. Patients may die having been on dialysis or never having been on dialysis, of course. Next slide. They may die in many different ways. Next slide. The family's view of the manner of dying and the care given will have a major effect on their bereavement and will echo down the years in the way they view death. We have to get this right because it's going to enter the narrative, the wonderful work of Sinead Donnelly, who's a palliative care physician and general physician in Wellington in New Zealand, and her sister, on the work of just the sense of how intensely felt and remembered this period of anyone's life experience and how families will remember this. And we need to make sure that this is a dignified and loving period and a period that there's a high degree of attention to all details rather than any sense of medical abandonment or agony or indignity. Next slide. So it might be that there's a major central event where this person may die suddenly, of course, and usually that's a cardiac event in these patients. Next slide. It may be negotiated withdrawal, and this is the situation where the person's exhausted. I can't keep going on with dialysis. The patient is now noting to be dementing, or the patient's got another life-limiting illness. So it may come to a point of negotiated withdrawal. Next slide. So this is an example who was a George who was on dialysis for 6 months, more fatigued, a non-STEMI, gangrene, etc. Next slide. So I guess the two approaches nephrologists might be this approach. This is slide 179. I'll let you read that. So that's one approach. The next approach could be next slide. So these are completely different approaches, aren't they? And so I guess it's the equipping nephrologists with communication skills and the ability to face the death of their own patients. Next slide. So it's, and I think it, all of this needs to be open and very honest. Next slide. And these are the questions that are asked, of course. Next slide, 183. If the patient is completely anuric, they estimate their mean survival time is usually 7 days. But if they're still passing urine, surprisingly, they may last weeks or months. Next slide. It may be, of course, a crisis withdrawal where the patient has a major, significant sentinel event, and then we're the patient is now dying, not because of the end-stage renal disease, because of that, a major AMI, a major stroke. Next slide. Now, there's two scenarios here. Of course, the event occurs. Next slide. The family is prepared for imminent death, dialysis has ceased, and there's a consensus there will be not escalation to ICU, etc. Next slide. But this scenario also can occur where the major sentinel event occurs. Next slide. There's no discussion about withdrawal. There's a waiting approach, and the patient either dies on dialysis or the day of dialysis. I would say to you that those families, the two sets of families, are going to remember this very, very differently. Next slide. And that scenario can be certainly assisted if there has been an advanced care plan and prior conversations. Next slide. So I'm going to stop here because this is the time for questions. I'm just going to slip through, and if whoever's with the slide, perhaps just come through here, and I'm going to come all the way down to yes, slide 216. Okay, I guess the whole thing of creating, well, I think part of this, of course, is simply talking with each other, nephrologists and palliative care, talking with each other, understanding each other's disciplines, reaching out into international literature, coming to education days, etc., and seeking advice. Next slide. We've had this annual renal palliative care symposium for Australia and New Zealand over the last couple of years, and we're about to host another one on July 29. So that'll be there, and all that there is for you if people wish to register. The next slide, we're going to have the pain day on the following day, that's slide 219, so you're welcome to come to that. Next slide. And the masterclass was held in 2015 and another one in Brisbane in 2016, and we'd be very happy to give you material on that. And the next slide, 221, you've got the details on that. And that'd be hopefully a very good day for anyone interested. What's the best material? Slide 222. Next slide. Well, look, I think that this is probably the best executive summary. This is an international gathering on renal supportive care, developing and developed countries, and I'd highly recommend that. Next slide. The Australasian Renal Supportive Care Position Statement, and that's been done by clinicians in both countries on all topics, including the issue of Indigenous nephrology, psychospiritual support, bereavement, symptomatology, etc., etc. So that would be hopefully a very good material for you, written by local authorities. Next slide. This is probably the best textbook, 2010. The second edition. Next slide. There was also a handbook, a nice handbook with very succinct summaries on this area, 226. And then of course that document I spoke about, 227, the clinical practice guidelines. Next slide. So in conclusion, slide 228. The role of palliative care, supportive care, really starts with a mutual acknowledgement of need. Next slide. The approach may come at multiple points in the trajectory of the disease. Next slide. The core competencies can and should be acquired by all doctors working with these patients. So it doesn't have to simply be palliative care. It really should be an enculturated aspect of nephrology care. Next slide. Applies to patients who are being managed either with dialysis or conservatively. Next slide. And your patients remain your patients until their death. And that's an important aspect for all of our work, isn't it? And I might just end with just a very small anecdote. I gave a similar talk to a group of nephrologists in Melbourne about 2 years ago, and the first question was a statement from a nephrologist at the back of the room. He said, "I need to tell you a story." And he was talking to his colleagues. He said, 6 months ago, there was a patient who really wanted to see dialysis. Dialysis was finished. I said to him, "You probably have about 10 days to live. You're welcome to stay in the hospital. hospital. The patient did stay in the hospital. The nephrologist said, I said to myself, I have nothing more to offer this patient. And in those next 10 days, and it was exactly 10 days later, the patient died. I walked past that room 3 times. I never entered the room. And it was after the death, the family came to me and said, you have been the nephrologist for our father for 10 years. Why didn't you come into the room? And he said, suddenly I realized it was more than the professional. It was the personal. I ought to have come into that room. I ought to have sat with that family, but I didn't. And he said, I've learned a very important lesson that, yes, I may feel I have nothing more to offer technically, but it's myself. It's myself as a clinician, as their doctor, that can have the most profound effect on people. Look, it's been lovely to have the opportunity to speak to you. Hopefully that was a good overview. I mean, there's obviously a lot more in each of these areas, but hopefully useful for you as an audience. I would certainly encourage both palliative care and nephrology to communicate, of course, and to keep talking with each other in terms of your own services, to reach out to your colleagues there in New Zealand who are already working in this area, including Kate and Nick, who are there in Christchurch, and others that I'm very much aware of. You're very welcome, of course, to attend these education days. And anything that I personally can do, or my colleagues in terms of both nursing staff and allied health can do to support you, you're most welcome. For the nephrologists in the room, Mark Brown would be very well known to you. Rob Walker, of course, in Dunedin, These clinicians, these nephrologists, have really led the way in this area. So, you know, by all means, you know, take advantage of speaking to them or making contact with them. And certainly, I can speak on behalf of Mark, who's head of department here. He's very happy for anyone to come and visit here, to spend some time with us, or indeed just to pick up the phone or email him and speak and talk through things. I hope you have a good day to everyone there.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now be disconnected.